blinking lights didn't work. Okay. I'm going to call the meeting to order. Today is April 20th, 2016. Can we get a roll call, please?
Yes. Trustee DeMartini?
Here.
Trustee O'Neill?
Here.
Trustee Grover?
Yes.
Trustee Riley?
Here.
Trustee Dillon?
Here.
Trustee Lynch?
Here.
Trustee Ford?
Here.
Trustee Sharp? Trustee Gordo?
Present.
Trustee Clendenin?
Here.
Is that the same roll call we do at the honor farm?
I don't know. I have never been to the honor farm. I did check the list.
Those are the trustees also, aren't they?
Your sentence is shorter. Okay, do we have any announcements?
Yes, we do. I'm very proud to announce our new employee, Teresa. If you could stand up, please. This is Teresa Clayton. She is our new retirement member and employer services technician. She comes to us from the district attorney's office, where she's been for many years. This is a lateral transfer for Teresa, and we are very, very excited to have her. She's already proven herself to be a very beneficial asset to our system. So, everyone, please welcome Teresa.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I also have one little tiny announcement, which has absolutely nothing to do with retirement, but it does have to do with this building. At the end of this month, the gates will be returning to auto open, and you will not have to badge out. You will still have to badge in, but we will be returning the gates to auto open on exit at the end of the month. So, just FYI. You guys are the first ones to know.
Thank you.
Any public comment? Matters under jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by the general public before or during the regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not posted in the agenda unless it is determined an emergency by the Board of Retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard once up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. It'll be me. Any person wishing to make a presentation to the board must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all board members. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. Seeing no members of the public, we'll move on. Do I have a motion on the consent calendar, or anyone want to remove something?
I'd like to pull 5E.
I'm glad you did, because I have an answer for you.
Okay. I just never seen anything like that.
Yeah. I'd like to move approval of all the items except for 5E.
Is there a second? Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Hearing none, we'll move on. Can we talk about...
I just have one comment on the consent item. So the complaint log, it was very nice to know that there was only 3 complaints or questions regarding insurance, which was down probably 1,000%. And so we appreciate working with you guys, and we think you've got it right by the RESCO administration.
That's good.
I'd like to add that it's been very benign now, the interactions with the insurance administrator, RESCO, and the members. So I would concur with what you're saying.
Okay, so moving on to 5E, we can talk about that letter that was received.
Before you say anything, I'll tell you that in members' forum, I'm going to bring this issue up because I want to find out if you want to agendize this to take further action on it. And I have a few tidbits of information to explain to you at that time. That, to me, seems like the proper forum to do it in.
Okay, I thought this was an unusual request. I wasn't sure if it's legality or if it had ever been done in the past. I don't recall if this ever came up.
Rip, why can't we do it now since it's an agenda item? Sure, we can, if you don't mind doing this.
San Diego does this, right? But didn't they have to have special legislation to be able to do it?
Nobody actually really does this. So if we can talk about this really fast.
Okay.
So I have to balance just facts with you guys and balance the questions that are asked, because this really isn't an agenda item. And if we want to make it an agenda item, then we can discuss the issue that I think is at hand here. So Really quickly, just some information. The IRS has a code section that allows a reduction in one's income, reportable income, for up to $3,000 based on the payment of health care premiums. This is only allowed for safety members, okay? The one issue about the IRS code is that essentially the money can't touch the members' hands. It has to go from the retirement system to the health care provider. That's what the code section said. So this member from Ceres Police Department actually made a request that we, Stan Sarah, administer this. In other words, we take money out of each person's check and send it to the provider of their choice. It's going to take some time, and we already do this one time with RESCO's insurance administrator, and the reconciliation process takes a lot of time. So if we have to do this for 10 or 15 other healthcare providers, it's really going to clutter things up. But the good thing is that we did some preliminary research with tax counsel, and they told us that they believe that the members, as long as they go through PGA/RESCO or the county pre-65, that they can take the deduction themselves. They don't need Stan Sarah to do anything different, that they can do it on their own. And so what I was going to ask you in members' forums, that we can still look to see what it would take to administer it for people who don't want to go through RESCO or who don't want to go through the county. But also, before you say yes or no, to let you know that this is actually on part of the RFP process for the new pension administration system, whereas we are going to be able to pay multiple vendors from our system. So the process in 2 or 3 years is going to be extraordinarily easy to do, whereas now we'd have to go through the reconciliation process manually each month with each healthcare provider, depending on who we're actually taking money from and shipping it to. So the question in members' forum was going to be, knowing what you know now, do you want us to research this some more and figure out what it would take to apply some workarounds now until we get to the point where we can do this highly automated in our system in a couple years? Also knowing that this member who wrote that letter can do it anyway. He lives in California, and he can actually, he's younger than 65, so he could actually go through the county and actually purchase insurance through the county and be able to claim this deduction on his own. That's what I was going to ask you guys in members' forum.
Does he know that?
I'm going to let him know after I get some idea from where you folks want to take this.
And you're saying with the new system, that won't be any strain on staff.
As soon as we get the new system operating, I don't care where they're from, I don't care who the money goes to, it'll be a piece of cake. It's just right now we go through this highly intense manual process each month to make sure that we reconcile. See, this RESCO PGA administrator, they tell us what to pay. They say, you need to cut us a check for this. Well, almost every month, I think, there's discrepancies. And we have to reconcile these discrepancies before we just pull money out of somebody's account and give it over to PGA. That we would have to do with each of our providers each month if we were to do some work around now. That's the issue.
I would just hate to have any public safety officers in our system not be allowed to take care of it and have to administer it, because we don't have all of the system yet. I don't.
So would the answer to your
figure it out
to Rick's question be yes, we would like to see that study done.
Okay. Even though you know that this gentleman can take this tax deduction on his own.
Well, you know that, and I don't believe you. I don't know if he knows that.
Oh, well, I'm gonna tell him.
If it maybe it all goes away.
Apparently he doesn't know that, or he wouldn't
agree. Right, I don't think he knows that. Well, we just kind of found this out this week.
There might be discrepancy in what tax, what advice attorneys are giving to you.
Could be.
It can be the one sees it that way and the other one doesn't.
Yep. But we did also reach out to, we talked to PGA Steve yesterday, and he said as far as he knows, there are other members who actually take this deduction even though the money is funneled through them. We talked to several systems, and the systems that we talked to coincidentally seem to all funnel their money through the county.
If they don't funnel it directly through the county, then they are handling it by allowing people to participate in through, like what we do with PGA. Some do it that way, and they are having the people to just take it on there. So if it either goes directly through the county, or if it's through a third-party administrator, then they just have them take it on their tax deduction.
Rick, I think I'd like to see it so steady no matter what, so we can make a clear statement to all of our public safety, current employees and retirees, and then have a policy in place so that as they finish up the details on our automation, it would just be built right into it.
And maybe also whether or not the county would be amenable to it.
And add it to what the previous
plan. Well, you said that some are paying right through the county?
They already do that. So the county already takes money. We already ship money off to the county each month for pre-65 folks.
But only for those vendors that are county vendors? Oh, for anybody?
Well, whoever the county is working with.
Oh, but I mean just those two healthcare providers.
Those are the two we currently take cut. Automate.
Yeah, but I mean, if they wanted somebody else entirely, the county wouldn't be amenable to those.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm clear. Thank you.
Okay, very good.
So do we need to take action on that item?
The 5E? I will bring it back in a month or so for an agenda.
But Rick, get a hold of the chief and see.
I'll let him know. I'll tell him in the meantime that he can still go ahead and do it based on what our tax count.
This is not a flag on that.
Right.
I believe you do still need to take a vote on receiving the correspondence. So.
Well, it's part of the consent. Yeah, yes,
as
you're right.
As the consent.
Okay, right, because it was pulled. Okay, so is there a motion to accept the correspondence 5E?
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. So our next item up is 6, Investment Manager Annual Presentation. We have Morgan Stanley here today.
Come on over.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Okay, Russ.
Kelly, is the conference call lineup?
Not yet.
Okay.
Do you want them online?
Why don't you dial it? Why don't you access them in now?
Will do.
So this is the annual presentation by Morgan Stanley for our infrastructure and our core real estate mandates. And I'd like to begin by thanking you for your time today and also thanking you for your business. We very, very much appreciate the opportunity to work for you, and we appreciate the trust that you've put in our firm. Many of you know me, but for those who don't, I'm Rob Harkins. I handle institutional relationship management and development in the Western U.S. I'm based in Los Angeles. Very shortly on the phone, we will have Jim Wilmot, who's one of the 6 senior partners who runs our infrastructure team. He's calling in from New York. And we also have Josh Meyerberg, who's one of 4 senior investments that run our core real estate group. And he's going to be calling in from San Francisco.
Good afternoon. Can you hear us?
Yes. Thank you. Can you hear us?
Yes, if you could just let us know who's online.
Sure, it's Jim Wilmot speaking.
Hi, this is Josh Meyerberg speaking.
Hey, guys. And this is Megan Golder.
Hey, guys, it's Rob Harkins. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah.
So I've just done introductions and... I'm about to just set our agenda. So in keeping with the directions given to us, we've geared our comments to last about 20 minutes today. We'll try our best to stick to this so that we can keep you on schedule. We're in the early stages of our relationship with you with regard to the infrastructure investment. The $50 million commitment closed in May of 2015, and the fundraise itself for our Fund 2 ended at the end of February of 2016. And with regard to real estate, your $50 million investment had funds flow on October 1st of 2015. So what we'd like to do is for each of the 2 mandates to give you a quick update overview of our team, our approach to investing, and how what we're seeing in the marketplace is shaping the portfolios. Please feel free to ask questions at any time. And if you would, just turn your presentation to page number 3, I'll start with an overview and then lead into infrastructure. So page 3 presents an overview of our investment management complex at December 31, 2015. And we closed the year with $406 billion in assets under management. And of this, $48 billion was in our real assets group. And within the real assets group, infrastructure represented about $5.1 billion. and real estate represented just under $20 billion. If you go to page number 4, I'll update you on the infrastructure investing team. There are a total of 75 dedicated professionals on the infrastructure team. There are 38 that are investors, and they're supported by another 37 that do things like tax, legal compliance, government relations. The team is led by 6 senior partners, and the leadership team is organized regionally with senior investors on the ground in Europe, Asia, as well as the U.S. And as far as the update goes, since you did due diligence on us in 2014, we've had no changes to the senior leadership team, and at the mid and lower level professionals that support the leadership team, we've only had 2 departures out of 31 total. So the team's the same team that you hired. If you'll go down to page number 5, I'll give you an update on the fundraise. Page 5 presents a summary of how the fundraise ended up. We raised a total of $5.8 billion, and that breaks down into $3.6 billion of direct commitments to the fund and $2.2 billion available for co-investment. A total of 41 institutional investors committed alongside yourselves, and institutional money represents about 95% of the total that was raised. Other institutional investors include CalPERS, Alaska Permanent Fund, New York Common, Texas Teachers, John Hancock, and right next door to us, Merced County. The fund's investment period will be 3 years from June, and then the fund's final termination will be 10 years from June. So I'm going to stop here, and I'm going to turn the floor over to Jim Wilmot, who's in New York, and he's going to take us through a couple of comments refreshing on our approach to investment and go over each of the 2 investments that we've made so far. Jim, can you hear me?
Thanks, Rob. So if you'll turn to page 6, I wanted to take the opportunity to remind you of the capabilities and the approach we have to investing. So you'll see on page 6, with our 75 team members, we differentiate ourselves upfront in deal sourcing and try to use the Morgan Stanley network and our network as a team to get exclusively negotiated deals rather than to participate in auctions. And you'll see nearly 3/4 of the investments made by Morgan Stanley Infrastructure, including the first 2 for Fund 2, where you're an investor, have been done on a negotiated basis. And that means we buy in at a lower entry price than had we participated in an auction. The second aspect is our operational value-add approach, where we aim to improve operations, so improve the performance of the assets once we acquired them. And in Fund 1, that meant to cash flow, so EBITDA, increasing by an average of 46% across the portfolio. So tremendous uplift in operating performance, and that leads to uplifts in value. And we're keen on cash flow because that ultimately leads to dividends for investors. And you'll see we achieved a 7.4% dividend yield across the operations for Fund 1, which is just above our target of 5 to 7% dividend yield, which we have for Fund 2. Fund 1, as of today, we're generating a 15.6% gross IRR and 10.4% net, both above our targeted ranges. We'll talk about the market opportunity in a second and our first 2 investments. If you'll turn to page 7, you'll see we plan to build a diversified portfolio of 10 to 12 investments for Fund 2 that will generate stable, predictable cash flows across the assets. We look for those that have cash flows linked to inflation, where the assets themselves have long useful lives, and where we have a pretty tight range of possible returns based on those predictable cash flows. We look for unique situations where we can carve assets out of larger corporate entities, participate in privatizations, and generally target undermanaged assets where with our intense operational improvement plan can drive value. The target market, you'll recall, is the OECD markets, both here in the U.S., north of us in Canada, in Europe, and then Australia. We've got five target subsectors where we look for opportunities and where we see very healthy pipeline of opportunities today. The target returns for Fund 2 are 12 to 15% on a gross basis, and that 5 to 7% cash yield. So about half the return coming from cash yield, a half from capital appreciation. If you'll turn to page 8, I thought I'd give you 2 minutes on each of the first two assets in Fund 2 where you've invested. So on page 8, the Tal Gas Storage is a gas storage facility we're developing in Italy, just outside of Milan. We made the investment in June. We made our first equity contribution in August. We've reached financial close in January of this year, and financial close means we secured all of the bank financing required to complete the development and started borrowing money. And today we've borrowed 109 million euros to begin construction of this facility. This facility is a depleted gas field, so a gas field that was producing gas for a number of years, ran out of gas. We're now re-injecting gas into the reservoir and we'll use it as a strategic supply for the country of Italy. And that's important for Italy as 90% of their gas is imported, and it unfortunately or unfortunately comes from Libya, Algeria, and Russia. So the country wants to make sure they have secure supply and secure storage in case there's disruptions to any of those three markets. We've invested $265 million out of the fund into this project, a 92.5% ownership, 7.5% remains with our local partner, and all is on track. Our two engineering firms, Schlumberger and Saipem, have begun their work in earnest at the beginning of the year. We expect construction to be completed in the middle of 2018. This will be, in effect, a core utility once completed, where we'll get revenues irrespective of the price of gas, irrespective of the volumes. It will be revenues just for the fact that we've got this safe, secure storage area for the country to give them the peace of mind they want from that that gas storage facility. On page 9, the other investment in the portfolio is Eureka Midstream, a $368 million investment we made back in the fall of 2014 in a gas gathering system in southeastern Ohio and West Virginia. We co-control this investment, so a 54% ownership. 46% is owned by Magnum Hunter, which is the third largest customer and the original developer of this gas pipeline system. Volumes are have increased dramatically during our ownership. We're running at 800,000 MMBTU today versus 656 in the fall of 15, and it was around 250,000 when we acquired it in the fall of 14. We've just executed a 15-year contract with Statoil, which is the state-owned Norwegian oil company and a big player in the shale gas and oil fields in the U.S., so we're very pleased about that contract. I note that Magnum Hunter, our partner, back in December, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. They have restructured their balance sheet, so their bondholders exchanged their debt for equity. We are in the process of finalizing the agreement with Magnum Hunter on changing and affirming the contract they have with us to use our pipes to extract all of their gas. That will then be confirmed by the judge, and then they'll emerge from Chapter 11 protection as a debt-free, cash-rich company. So a better partner for us. It's a situation we contemplated when we first made the investment back in 2014, and we're very pleased with the result of the negotiations and of their restructuring. So it's basically made what could have been a bad situation quite good for us over the long term. So that's Eureka Midstream. In general, the Eureka Midstream is running today at a 10% IRR based on structural protection we have in terms of our equity ownership. We, in effect, have a preferred right over Magnum's equity stake. Italian gas storage, we've been marking just up from cost since it's still very early days as we develop that asset, but both on track. There's not a page on it, but in terms of the pipeline, we're very excited about the investment environment today. We're taking advantage of the volatility that you're seeing in the public markets, so in the listed securities, to find very attractive opportunities. And I'd say as important, we're taking advantage of opportunities that have become available through the low oil price. So the assets we tend to invest in don't have price risk per se in their assets. So we're, you know, I don't want to say immune, but protected from the downturn in either the gas or oil prices. And yet those same downturns are providing us good opportunities as the oil majors look to divest infrastructure assets, free up capital for their balance sheet needs, and we can buy key infrastructure assets from them. So we expect to make a number of investments this year, and we believe, you know, in particular on this theme, we'll be able to take advantage of the dislocations in the markets.
Are there any questions?
I don't know if there's any questions in the room before I turn it over to Josh and Meg.
Josh, Meg, why don't you guys take us into real estate?
Thanks, Rob. So I want to start off by thanking the board for your support of Prime. I know that the plan has only been invested for a couple of quarters at this point, but we are grateful for you guys supporting the fund and look forward to a long-term relationship with you. I want to be brief today. I think I've got about 6 minutes left on our 20-minute clock. So as a very quick and high-level summary, Prime Property Fund is essentially simply just a larger version of the fund that you guys selected back in May of 2014. We are employing the same strategies, we have the same management team, and we've demonstrated the same continued strong performance over the last several years since you guys made the decision to invest. Let me dive quickly into the specifics. We'll start on page 11 of the presentation that we sent over. On this page, you'll note the top box here is as of March 31st. The rest of the presentation is as of December 31st, 2015. The fund has grown now to be $19 billion of gross assets at fund share, $16 billion of equity or net assets, 19.3% leverage. We've actually taken leverage down the last several years. Up to 341 assets, 258 investors, and the fund is currently 93.1% leased, so continued strong occupancy. As we look down below, a key theme for Prime is our consistent outperformance of the index. Over 1 year, we've outperformed by 82 basis points, 3 years, 247, 5 years is 226, and 10 years is 158 basis points. So with this outperformance, you know, logical question to ask is kind of how we do it. So let me give you my quick thoughts on that. first and foremost, is a very strong investment team. We have a group that does not settle for buying assets at market for paying the highest price in a brokered process or for mediocrity in general, nor do we believe that we should dilute our existing shareholders by investing capital at market pricing when that's not really our cost of capital. And so the team is very strong. We buy assets well, and we manage them well. Second is our strategies, and I'll talk about these briefly, but these have not changed since you guys invested. They are time-tested, they are research-driven, they work, and we stick to the strategies that have worked historically for us and maintain our discipline. Next is a focus on asset management. Growing cash flow, this is a theme that Jim alluded to as well. For Prime Property Fund, over the last 5 years, we have grown net operating income, which is the primary income metric of real estate, by 7% over that time period versus the index at 4.4%. So this laser focus on growing cash flows, which frankly provide our investors some downside protection whenever the next recession comes, because we have grown the underlying cash flows and we're not taking nearly as much capital markets risk as perhaps some of our peers are. And last is AMLI and Safeguard. The captive operating companies that really help to drive our outperformance, particularly AMLI, given their scale and the strength of their operations. It is a real differentiating factor for us among our peer set. As we put the page on the team, nothing material has changed on this page. The fund continues to be led by a long-tenured and experienced management team. We've experienced no changes in our senior leadership. The portfolio management team has an average of 13 years of dedication to the fund and over 22 years with Morgan Stanley or its predecessors. So again, these are this team and the supporting staff underneath have been a key contributor to the fund's outperformance over the long run. Diving specifically into the portfolio on page 14 in your book, to highlight our strategies again, just to jog everybody's memory, we are in office buildings. We have a $6.9 billion office portfolio that is primarily located in the center of cities. These are Class A buildings in major markets like San Francisco, Boston, Washington, D.C., New York, and L.A., and a few others. On retail, the vast majority of the portfolio is in regional malls. Regional malls are exceptionally hard to buy. Because of Prime's 40-plus year history, we have been able to cultivate a high-quality mall portfolio. In addition, we own some urban, high-quality urban retail in major markets like Beverly Hills or Southern Manhattan that, frankly, augments the regional mall portfolio as a place that tenants want to be. On the apartment side, we own 23,000 units, all under the AMLI brand and operated by AMLI, again, in major markets throughout the country. Industrial is port-centric. We own about 25 million square feet in major port markets like Los Angeles, Northern New Jersey, the Bay Area, Seattle, and a few others. And it's self-storage, similar to the AMLI story. Safeguard Self-Storage manages all of our self-storage facilities. That portfolio has grown and is now over $900 million. Flipping to page 15 down below, the portfolio as a whole at over 300 assets may be somewhat overwhelming to understand, but the top 10 assets comprise nearly 30% of the fund's value. So these assets on the page are the ones to really focus on. This is the same list that you guys saw 2 years ago. The only addition on here is the one on the bottom right, which is an example of some of our investment activities. We bought 3301 to 3307 Hillview Avenue in Palo Alto a year ago. This is an asset, as you guys know, in a very strong submarket in Palo Alto. We purchased it for a 6.4% going-in income yield. and 3% bumps inside the lease, so the rents increase by 3.5% each year. So over the 12-year term of the lease, it'll be a 7.7% average NOI yield, which is exceptionally strong, particularly given the quality, again, of the submarket in which this building sits. Bear with me for just a few more slides, and then I'll open it up for questions. On page 16, we show our lease status. The portfolio continues to be very well occupied. Yeah, that is a demonstration of how strong our asset base is. For example, our office portfolio is about 95% leased versus a national average of 90%. And because tenants want to be in our buildings, it's allowed us to push rents. And as I said up front, yeah, this has really driven net operating income growth in the portfolio well beyond our peer set, growing at 7% per year. On page 17, the chart on the left, the pie chart on the left, is our sector allocation. The pie chart on the right is the index's sector allocation. What you see on here is the pie charts, frankly, aren't very different. And so what that tells you is what's really driving the outperformance of our fund versus our peers is that we own better assets and we manage them very well. Strategically, office has slid down a bit. That is a theme that you may see continue as office, as we go deeper into the economic cycle. Office is the most volatile of the property types that we own. And so, you know, strategically, it's a bit of a defensive play on our part to modestly tick down our allocation to office. Otherwise, you'll continue to see similar allocations going forward. On page 18, the geographic concentration of the portfolio, we remain in the top seven markets in the U.S., an overweight. That's 71% of the portfolio versus the index at 59%. These major markets are, again, a nice source of outperformance for us. And yet again, that will be our focus as we look at acquisition opportunities going forward. Last two pages to bring you to page 21, our debt profile. The fund is at 19.3% leverage. That's a loan-to-value ratio. We are rated by Moody's and Standard & Poor. We continue to be the top-rated real estate company by S&P that they rate. I think they rate something like 70 real estate companies. So, you know, good validation of our risk mitigation policies. Average cost of debt at 4% is well inside in line with the index. And you'll see us move inside that based on some debt offerings that we've done this last quarter as we look forward. We've continued to extend term. Our weighted average term is 5.7 years. And again, as you look forward over the next several quarters, you'll see that we have extended term and continue to de-risk our debt stack, which is important, again, as we prepare for whenever the next recession is upon us. The last page to turn you guys to, which is my favorite in the book, is page 24. On here, you'll see the net and gross performance of Prime. That's the dark blue bar and the lighter blue bar. And then the gross and net performance of the index. That's the orange bar and the yellow bar. What you see over 3, 5, and 10 years is that Prime's after-fee performance has been better than the index's before-fee performance. So we continue with very strong performance relative to the benchmark, and hopefully you guys continue to have confidence that your capital and real estate allocation is in good hands. So let me know if you have any questions or for either I or for Jim.
Doesn't appear to be.
Any questions?
So is our
$15 million
totally committed in these funds?
Josh, the $15 million investment is completely invested in the Prime Property Fund now. Yes.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, again, we really appreciate your business. We're one of the few companies in the world that's truly global. We have 57,000 people in 43 countries. There's anything that you guys need, anything you need to know, anything you think we can help you with, please, please just give us a call.
I do have one quick question.
Sure.
So there was something interesting in here about the dividend yield.
Yep.
And it was
Talking about on the
North Haven?
On North Haven.
North Haven.
Sure.
Yeah.
Jim, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. So it's discussed as being gross. And so how should we think about fees coming out of the dividend, and what should we actually expect on a net basis to the plan?
Jim, can you take that?
So in fund one, you'll remember on my page we had a 15.6% gross IRR. That's comprised both the dividend yield and capital appreciation. And the capital appreciation comes when you both sell assets or when you mark them up because they're performing so well, even if you haven't sold them. The net on that 15.6 was 10.4 to date. There's really no way of splitting up the kind of dividend yield on a gross and net, because you don't really take all the, you know, kind of fees or performance fees against, you know, one stream versus the other. I mean, the way the funds work, you'll recall, is it's a 5-year investment period. So over the first 5 years, there'll generally be cash on a net basis, cash outflow as you make more investments in the fund. There'll be some capital that will be returned in terms of dividends, particularly on the investments that are made earlier in that 5-year period. And then when the commitment period is ended, all cash flows will go back to you, whether as dividends or as we start to sell off the assets. And we've got a 12-year life fund. We tend to sell assets after 5 to 7 years.
So, Rick, maybe you can help me, because I wasn't here when the decision was made to invest in this fund, or any of the trustees for sure. Was it introduced to you as being an income-generating investment? Infrastructure typically is. And so understanding how that contributes to the portfolio and how that breaks out, I think, is...
Okay. I don't know if I recall, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I'd have to go back and look.
So again, of the target return of 12 to 15%, we expect 5 to 7% coming from income, so annual dividends from the assets, and then the remainder coming from capital appreciation. So 5 to 7% dividend yield, so current income, and the remainder coming from capital appreciation. That was our history with Fund 1 portfolio, and that's the target for Fund 2 portfolio as well.
And that's gross, and all the fees come out of that?
Correct.
Is there something, Ed, that you feel we should be exploring a little more?
In terms of portfolio construction and using infrastructure and thinking about the role it plays in the portfolio, we would think of it as sort of an inflation hedge, an income-generating, stable asset
value. So where does it fit in the asset allocation?
Right. And so how should we expect that? So hearing 5% sounds really good. We'd like that. But if fees have to be calculated, and then if it's over the life of the fund, well, when do those... actually come into us?
Is that typically, an investment takes, I'd say, 18 months to start generating dividends. So we tend not to get dividends the first couple quarters of ownership. So usually it takes 12 to 18 months to generate a dividend. The 5 to 7% kind of dividend stream would be at the end of the commitment period. So on the run up there, there'll be a number of assets that will start generating dividends after, as I said, 12 to 18 months of ownership. but you won't be, you know, on the investment in total, you wouldn't see that 5 to 7% yield until the end of the 5-year commitment period. Because, you know, certainly we'll use year 3 as an example. In year 3, you'll still be investing capital out of your commitment into new investments. Those brand new ones won't yet start generating a yield for, say, 12 months, but then some of the initial investments will start to generate a yield, but it won't offset the capital that you'll need to invest. But once you've invested, we expect the 5 to 7% dividend yield to be a good target.
Okay. And Rob just shared with me that he can help pull together the numbers of what Fund 1 looked like and take a look at that profile, and that'll help us understand.
Exactly. Be happy to do that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, we'll follow up.
And I would say the investors the large percentage of investors who came into Fund 2 invested in infrastructure because it's inflation protected, it's stable returns, there's a current yield that come out of the assets, and they were using this as a, you know, fixed income substitute or infrastructure, you know, specific allocation in their portfolio. Mm-hmm.
Great. Jim, thank you very much. Josh, Meg, thank you very much for your time. And that's it. We're happy to follow up in any other way, too.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Okay.
What's that photo of?
That photo, I believe, is part of the gas storage or gas distribution system that's part of Madrid. And in fund number one, one of the assets was the last mile of gas pipes in the city of Madrid. So every time someone cooks dinner at night, Fund 1 gets a couple of pennies.
Cool.
Oh, you know what? I wanted to tell you one other thing. I gave to Kelly invites. Our annual LP meeting is in mid-May in New York. It's the 16th and the 17th, or the 15th and the 16th. And we'd all very, very much like for you to come. And if you can't come this year, please put it on your schedule to come next year. And if you can combine that with 3 or 4 hours of due diligence at our headquarters, and we'd love to show you our whole shop.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Does it really matter if the foreman is 15%, or they're 10% paper appreciation and 5% cash? It's working?
Yeah, absolutely, because you don't have a tax consequence either way, right. So it's not that kind of issue. Right. It gets back to a role in the portfolio kind of thing. And so if we're looking at that as income generating and we want to have a steady stream of cash flow, that can be viewed differently than the price appreciation play. So typically, like I said, I wasn't here when it was introduced to you. So typically this kind of fund is introduced for those properties. And then understanding how it's actually working once you are an investor in it, I think is pretty key. The fees on these things are pretty high. You see a 15% IRR get trimmed down to a 10 IRR. We're the ones bearing the risk. We're the ones who collect that, but they're bearing very little risk in collecting that 5% IRR for themselves. So that's something that we want to pay close attention to. Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Can I ask you to take one of the pets? Passing out the...
Just one comment. My thought was, why aren't we selling gas to Italy?
Natural gas?
Yeah.
It doesn't transport well.
And have to put it in a ship. Take it over there.
Yeah. One of our ships from Rio.
Yeah, that's right. We have to have an anchor. I think we have home storage.
They're working on that, though. And so that's the February performance report, and here's the March flash. So we're working on that. The February one we talked about last time as being partially due to the date that is agreed upon between us and your custodian, Northern Trust. And so we reached out to them and said, instead of 11th business day, how about we move it to, I think we landed on the 9th.
Yep.
We got two days.
So that should help us. Yeah. So just
the timing of information then.
That's right. And so February is now a bit dated. We saw February hit the lows in the equity markets, a nice rebound through the end of February and then into March. So you see that February was basically flat for the plan overall. March has a nice increase, 4.6%, bringing year-to-date basically to zero, negative 0.2% on a net of fees basis. As you scan down through the columns, though, you see that our active managers did not do real well. It's kind of odd that all of them are having troubles at the same time. Jackson Square Partners underperformed in March by 5 full percentage points, 1.7 versus 6.7. They're a concentrated fund, so they will have those episodes of strong underperformance and outperformance. But you can see for the year now, they're down 6.3% versus their index at 0.7. Also, modest underperformance from Dodge and Cox for the month and year to date. Legato and Capital Prospects roughly in line for the month of March and down on year to date, 1 versus 1.7. A couple lines below that, Pyramus. Wanted to just note that we actually have a discrepancy we're researching between what Northern Trust is showing and what Pyramus is showing for their year to date performance. We have, on a gross of fees basis, minus 1.9%. So here we're showing it net of fees at negative 2. Pyramus is actually showing a negative 2.2% gross of fees basis. So we're still reconciling that. We'll keep you posted. I think we'll have that squared away by the time you see the quarterly report next month.
Ed, do you guys monitor tracking error on a semi-regular basis?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. You're right. Jackson Squares, that's pretty out of whack.
That is.
It surprises me.
Yeah. So we have those pages in the quarterly performance report.
So that company holds their stuff too long. You know, they've got stocks like Qualcomm.
Oh, right.
For like 10, 15 years. You know, when they get a profit on it, they never sell it. They just hang on to it. Then it drops.
Well, they only, I mean, they're pretty convicted.
They don't turn over their stocks the way
20 positions.
Right. Right.
22 positions.
Yeah. Very concentrated. We can take a closer look at them next quarter. They're also going through the issues we talked about before with their separation from Delaware funds. And we always ask the question about, is that creating any instability? No, is what we've been told. And so we haven't seen any personnel departures, which is good. And that would be the key thing there in terms of what drives the performance results.
So will we get these before the meeting in the future? Will we get these reports?
We think so. We think that this changing the Northern Trust by 2 days is going to be beneficial, and I think we have another agenda topic too.
I was just going to say that also depends on what's coming later on when we talk about our meeting schedule. It's a tough one to answer, right? It's
we are working on getting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really,
that's the goal, Mike.
The shift from going to the from the fourth Tuesday to the third Wednesday was really the biggest culprit here.
So we literally had the data for the March report on Monday. Get it on Monday, create the report, print it, bring it to you today. So that's actually our timeline on that one.
So if the rebalancing is not reflected, you're right, that be in the future months?
Yeah. So
like in April starting or something?
That's right. So the rebalancing, is that actually completed at this point?
Kathy was going to give an update.
Yeah, I was going to tell you right now. It's actually in process right now, and the final pieces will settle tomorrow.
Okay.
And we should have the post-trade notes in the next week sometime.
Okay.
So we'll have everything for the next meeting.
Yeah.
Detail. So it's went fairly smoothly.
Okay. Asset allocation status update.
Yeah, so just wanted to touch base with you. I don't have a handout or anything to discuss at this point, specifically, other than now that we've gone through several of our discussions, wanted to get a sense for your input on what you were hearing and what you were seeing. And if you remember back, there was an educational session on emerging market equity, a session on private equity investing, and a session on risk parity. as well as the discussion last month about the functionally focused portfolio approach to portfolio creation. So we have a lot of moving pieces on the table when we think about all of that. So it's hard for us to really model something and give it to you because so many combinations and permutations of what we could be doing there. So maybe we should go through them kind of one by one and see where you land on it in terms of emerging market equity. Is that something we should consider our current approach, which is using international equity managers to make that decision of how much to put in EM? Or are we comfortable saying we want EM explicit mandates because we want to increase our exposure to emerging markets?
Well, I would not go there myself.
You're talking about taking it out of U.S. equity?
No, just in terms of overall portfolio creation. And so it wouldn't be specific about making a dollar trade from one to the other. It would be as we think about what we should present to you. Should we show you mixes that contain emerging market higher than what an ACWI ex-US mandate would give us? In other words, today we invest in international equities, and when we say we're putting $10 in there, essentially two of it is going into emerging markets because it's about 20% of the index goes into EM. And if we want to say, that's not enough, EM actually has some really nice return characteristics, and we need to get return for our portfolio, and we're long-term investors, so we could actually hold more than just that 20%. But to do so, we'd have to have a dedicated EM manager. Is that something we want to do, or is that?
I don't think so.
Hasn't the emerging markets done poorly over the last few years?
So it depends on time frame. This past year and a half, they definitely corrected, and in the past month and a half, they've rebounded like crazy. So it is the volatility of that space. I think there was a 4-year run there where they were the single best performing asset class, like 2007 to 2011. And if you weren't in that, you missed out on a ton of great opportunity. And then 2012, they corrected by 50%, so you gave half of it back. They have that kind of volatility profile, which is what we model. I mean, we don't shy away from that. Our model captures that and says, yeah, this has some real volatility to it. And so if we want to invest in this, we need to be patient investors and know that. But if it's too much volatility, let's not do it.
What do you think, Gordon?
I think if we have a 50-year time horizon as a fund, which we do, it makes a tremendous amount of sense to at least do the research to uncover quality EM managers and give it great consideration, because if we're in a low yield environment in the bond market and we feel that there's not a great story in the U.S. market for continued growth, where are we going to make our 7.75%? And if we have, like I said, a 50-year time horizon, I think we absolutely should be looking at emerging market managers. That's what I think. I think that we would be foolish not to explore any and all opportunities to make a more consistent and predictable rate of return for the employees of San Luis County.
You think the 20% ex-US is not enough?
Well, remember, it's 20% to international markets.
Right.
And it's, so you said it was $2 of every $10 goes to
EM.
Mm-hmm. So that's a really small allocation to the emerging markets.
So are we talking about increasing the percent that goes to emerging markets from that 20%, or are we talking about increasing?
It sounds like we'd be thinking about taking assets from somewhere else and making a bigger play in emerging markets.
Be open to exploring the increasing the allocation to international markets at the same time. So not necessarily taking from developed international markets to give to the EM, but to increase our allocation to the global markets. And underneath that, increasing the emerging markets allocation.
Yeah.
And do you have any graphics or anything that we could look at some point in time that shows that they're more volatile, but in general, with there's a glide path in there somewhere.
There's a glide path in there somewhere, yeah.
Would that help to look at over a long, like Jason's saying, you got 50 years to look at it. I mean, do we have like 20 years back we can look at it?
Yes, and in fact, that's what the education deck had some of that in there. So it was pointing that out.
And my guess is the fact that we had three education decks in a row, probably we don't remember a whole lot of
Fair enough. We knew it would be a lot to take in. So,
so in the last series of portfolio mix that you had given to the board, I guess in the last few months, there was a greater mix of these, right? There were different mixes
yes.
that you had outlined.
Yeah.
So we could look into that as to what our comfort level is, right, I guess.
That's exactly right. And I think what we showed you was that your current portfolio today is somewhere around 5% in emerging markets, maybe a little less than that. Do you want to go 7, 8, 9, 10% in emerging markets?
I think it depends on
that's
what
essentially
from.
Well, absolutely. So it, the idea that I'm trying to probe a little bit here, Mike, is basically saying, is that an idea you're open to considering? And if it is, then I'll show you some mixes that have that, and you'll see where it comes from. Because the idea is that we'd want to put together a set of portfolios that are efficient, that are going to give us the most bang for the buck, the most return for the least risk. So if you're open to considering that, that gives us another arrow in our quiver that we can use. And we can say, okay, looking at EM, we can play with those numbers beyond just the constraint of what our ACWI managers do today.
Can we define more what we're specifically saying with EM? Because it's a very general thing. Where we enter into the question of like Russia and other such things.
So, good question. That's where we would get into specific investment manager selection and investment management guidelines. So
it's a comfort level. I mean, just saying I'm going to throw it out in EM is different than being comfortable where I'm putting it.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
I'm open to looking at that kind of deal. What I'm not open to is having an ironclad. We must have X percent in this, mm-hmm. no matter what. Mm. I think that's just frank and stupid, but I'm looking at on the way.
So what I hear you saying is that you're open to increasing the target, but you want a large range.
Yeah, I want to know where. Yeah, and I want to know where you're.
These countries have known political instability and exchange rate mm-hmm. problems, currency fluctuations. Mm-hmm. If you have just a rigid, we're going to put in so much money, you never sell when it's high. You just keep putting money in and it just drops like it did the last time. And you have to be able to sell these if you've got a profit sometimes. I don't see that happens in these. You just ride them up and then back down again.
I think that's because we were so low to what our target was. If we were closer to what our target was, then you would have to sell it to rebalance out.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question because today when we have our international equity managers, we've basically hired them to make that decision. So if they are looking at emerging markets and saying they're cheap, they can scale that back within their guidelines. And if they're expensive, they can scale it back. And if they're cheap, they can increase it. If we went with a direct EM approach, then the board owns that decision. And you can say, we want out of EM entirely, or we want to invest more specifically with this or these managers focusing on EM.
But you run some risk. You run some significant board risk.
That's right.
In that scenario.
That's right.
You know, because we could all get really unhappy really quickly with the poor performance of any manager, and specifically emerging markets, because they do move very fast.
Yeah.
So we lock in the loss because we got mad at the guy.
Right. Right. Think about it. Right. The last couple of years have been dreadful.
Yeah.
But the last 6 or 7 weeks have been incredible, and you know you that's right. You lock in the loss.
How risky investment for retirement for?
Well, I would say there's more risk in being conservative for a retirement board. We have a big number. We got to make 7.75% net. And there aren't a lot of assets out there that are going to provide that over the next decade. And if you have a well-diversified portfolio that includes some much faster members of the team, couple that with some slower members of the team, the bond index, when you talk about the U.S. stock market, I mean, you tell me, in 10 years, why would stocks go up here? And 46% of our money is in domestic stocks, and only 18% is in international. And of the 18%, only 3% is in emerging markets, if my math is right.
Right.
So, I mean, it's pretty widely adopted that the international equity markets are probably going to be a better place to have money over the next decade than the U.S. market. And we don't have a lot of exposure there. And I agree, Jim, if we put 10% of our fund in emerging markets, yeah, that's probably crazy. But to have no exposure there or to not have a manager giving us great guidance there, that's almost just as bad.
Okay, so in the next item on the agenda on the experience study, there's one paragraph that struck me. It says that our investment consultant says that his projection for our return in the next 10 years is 6.1%. We're in this at 7.
That's our current portfolio.
Right, 7.25. So, first of all, is 7.25 unreasonable? Is it irresponsible?
I want to answer.
Both of these guys can give you a different.
So, it says it right here.
No. I think it's a valid question, and the answer to it is, the current portfolio with our economic assumptions doesn't get you there. And that's point one.
Is that after the changes that we've made in the demographics?
Yes. So that's point one. And point 1A to that would probably be, we use our set of assumptions. Other investment consultants use theirs. We'll differ here and there. They won't dramatically change that. So it's not like if you took their assumptions and plugged it in that you would get to 7.25. You might get higher, though. None of these are perfect. None of us have a crystal ball. So there's the chance that you could indeed outperform 7.25. It just seems to us that it's a lower probability.
So you think that this investment strategy going to emerging markets can make up the gap?
Okay. So point two on your question is exactly that. When we take a look at the asset allocation mixes we created for you, and we compare that to the current, we showed you a number of mixes that have both higher return with lower volatility. And that makes it really challenging to not say, shouldn't we adopt a better solution, one that gives us both better return and lower volatility, even when it has private equity invested in, emerging markets, these other risky asset classes, because of the way they work together, creates a more stable return profile. So that's the two-part answer to that question.
You have no idea. We don't know if we can do this. But
well, I still don't have the crystal ball. Yeah.
You would not recommend, if it were your recommendation, that we base our
We haven't decided on our asset allocation yet.
Exactly.
Using our current mix, what we have right now, he's saying you're not going to get there.
Right.
The other part of it is, if you want to get there, you need to make some changes.
Well, I think the other part of it that we haven't talked about is, if you don't want to get there, if it's 6.1,
then you got to go to the contribution side.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's another $15 million charter
every year. Yeah, the supervisors need to go back to the employers and say, give us some more dough.
Because we cripple our partners.
Right.
Ed, let me ask you this question. On our bond portfolio, we currently have about 28% allocation to bonds. What do you anticipate those bonds providing to us over the next 5 years?
Your bond portfolio as it is today includes Dodge & Cox and PIMCO.
Yep.
Dodge & Cox is more credit-oriented,
yep.
So they're taking more of the company risk. PIMCO has a bit of that, as well as a variety of other.
This is a two-part question, by the way.
Okay. So it has a variety of other. So in today's interest rate environment, we look at it and say interest rates are pretty low. Can they go lower? Yeah. Actually, all the other developed countries in the world have lower rates than we do. When we look at our growth projections in the U.S. at this kind of 2 to 3% that we're currently in, that suggests that interest rates are not going to go up. So low interest rate environment with a chance of them going down, some chance of them going up as well. So take that with a band of outcomes. So it doesn't look like the fixed income side is going to generate much income for us. Even when you consider the credit, credit is what they call reaching for yield. So yeah, you're investing in companies instead of sovereign bonds. And when you invest in companies, they'll pay a higher return. You also absorb the risk of potential defaults or downgrades or whatever corporations may be facing in their individual businesses. So you take on credit risk when you do it with Dunton Cox. So you have a challenging fixed income portfolio, low returns there.
So, I mean, are you saying 3%? Again, we're just pontificating here. We're not.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm writing it down.
Yeah. I remember 3.2 or 3.5 or something.
Yeah, here's where I'm going.
You're
right?
Very good.
A third of our portfolio is going to provide us 40% of the return that we need over the next 5 years, right? It's only going to provide 3.5% of our stated 7.25% needed return. What's the driver to create our equity portfolio? What's the story that's going to make our equity portfolio generate 12% so we can average down to that 7.25%?
So,
and I guess I'm just helping you bring us asset allocation models that get us closer to a 7.25%, 7.5%. More predictable, stable, and consistent returning portfolio.
So when we think about that, those kinds of dilemmas, here's what we're looking at for the numbers. These are the inputs into our modeling. So the 3.2%, which Jeff was spot on with the core fixed income. U.S. Treasury is even lower than that at 2.3%. High yield debt looks rather attractive at 7.1%. So investing in the lower quality companies actually has some upside potential. International developed markets at 9%, emerging markets at 11%. So those two would be critical in terms of getting exposure there. And then we get into the alternatives. Risk parity generating 7%, private equity generating 8%, private credit generating 9%. So we have to be willing to take on the illiquidity to get those kinds of returns. Risk parity is liquid. The other two, private equity and private credit, are less liquid. So
when you talk liquidity, you're talking months, years?
So private credit and private equity years, 7-year, 10-year, those kinds of lockups.
So we're saying we think interest rates are going to be where they are for 10 years?
Essentially, yeah, because these are 10-year projections, that's right.
And they've been here for 10 years.
So we're going to be here in 10 years.
I mean, for 10 years we've been saying, watch out, rates are going to go up.
You quoted treasuries at 2 point something.
That's right.
But what are treasuries in Europe? They're like a negative.
Oh.
You pay them to hold your money.
That's right.
So boy, now we
had a couple of bad quarters, we would start retreating towards that, wouldn't we?
In 08, we actually had that in 08.
Yeah.
In October of 08, you actually put $1,000 into a 10-year treasury, and you're guaranteed to get back $990. Mm-hmm. And it just in 10 years, you gave them $10.
And I don't see them moving that quickly. Even if they started moving, it may take them 10 years to get up around 5 or 6%. I mean, it's not going to...
Oh, the Fed?
They're doing it so incrementally. I mean, it's like a snail.
Well, the problem is there's no story to drive the growth. I mean, as you look into the marketplace, other than Apple, who do you see making real significant money in the marketplace and expanding their business and growing and hiring Americans to pay for the houses that people are trying to sell? There's no wage growth. There's no inflation. There's just no economic stimulus that's going to drive our economy over the next 3 to 5 years to give the Fed reason to raise rates.
And some of them are very short term. They come out, they look great, they're making a profit for a year and a half or 3 years, and then they're gone. They're of what they were 2 years earlier.
So all this to say, I would welcome you to come back to us with an emerging markets manager and an asset allocation that you think would make more sense for our fund to hopefully achieve that state of return of 7.25%.
So what you're basically saying is you feel during the next 10 years, India, China, other markets will do much better than America?
If I had to say, pick either emerging markets to put my money in or the U.S. market to put my money in, and I could only pick between those two things, which one would win, I would lean towards the emerging markets.
Any specific emerging markets you feel comfortable in? Because I have problems in several of them, and I agree with you, there may be some decent ones. What are your thoughts as to which country? I mean, you're talking about India, talking about China, talking about Russia, Brazil.
Africa? All the above.
So we sit here and say we think Africa...
So, Gordon, are there issues and political...
Exchange rates?
There's exchange rates, there's accounting issues, there are political issues. What's that?
Argentina was in the Wall Street Journal this morning because they have the dubious record of the largest emerging market debt default on record.
Right.
They recently completed the largest debt raise on record for an emerging market country.
Oversubscription.
Yeah.
Four times or something like that.
So we're probably going to lose our money, but we're willing to give it to them anyway. but, Gordon, we have to have a manager who has a lot more experience and a lot more wisdom and a lot more information and knowledge to make investments in emerging markets.
But it feels to me like what you're saying is let's gamble with getting a guy who can do it right when we don't know.
I'm not saying gamble. I'm saying we need to be smart with the money that the employees of Stanislaus County have entrusted us to manage. And it's foolish. It would be foolish in my mind if I sat here and said we shouldn't look at emerging markets because that's just too risky. I think we've not done the employees of Stanislaus County our best work, and we've not provided our best thinking if we're just closed to a new concept.
I agree with that.
I'm not saying we got to go put 10% in emerging markets, but we should at least look at it.
I'd like to know a lot more about it.
The manager should apply to every manager we hire in every field.
Absolutely.
Find the best people, and you have to hold them to the test.
I'm sorry, I was going to say,
here's the problem that Ted has, is that 3 months ago, came to us with that same, you guys are going to make 6, and you need to make 7. It was 7.75% last time you were here, but now it's like 7.25%.
Fred, let me know.
Okay. So we'll at least lower the hurdle that much. He brought to us his best scenario after our day at Seasons or whatever it was.
Right.
He says, do you like this one, this one, this one? We said no.
Right. The dilemma.
So it's still, you still got the same problem. Is we're going to have to come out of our shell somewhere.
Well, and maybe we should begin by, I don't think there's a silver bullet here.
Nope.
This is almost some of these discussions are not presidential debates. We're going to lower taxes, increase the military, restore Israel, take care of all this and that, and go to the wall. And nobody's going to have to pay anything more for anything.
Well, give everybody more.
it's all a bunch of nonsense. And there isn't a silver bullet or an easy answer. I don't know if extensive investments in emerging markets, which I would want to know the country and what they were doing, gives us a much greater return or significantly better return than investments in American companies in Florida or the Midwest. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You've got to tell us that. I'm willing to consider all of it. I don't want to get locked into a formula that says we got to give 10% of the portfolio to emerging markets, and we define those as people or companies in Africa. Mm-hmm. That's just crazy talk.
Well, part of that may be addressed by who we select. And so I think when we talk about emerging markets in general, I think we're kind of talking about like an index of emerging markets because we think of them collectively as do we want to invest in this asset class or not. When we actually hire a manager to do it, we would recommend selecting an active manager because they're going to be making those country-specific decisions, those company-specific decisions, And that's what we think their value is, that they do that research and it pays dividends for us. So we'd want to have active management doing that.
So Ed, like within EM, there's some industries, there's different sectors, right? I mean, some sectors are less riskier than other sectors, wherever they may be, whichever country.
Right.
So if we do hire an active manager, then it doesn't make any sense to hire them if we're still going to be at 2% of the total portfolio. I think it only makes sense if we go higher in our portfolio to hire an active manager, right? So I'd be willing to look at it for sure.
Yeah.
I think for me, the biggest issue is that we still have not settled on an asset allocation.
Ah, great point. You have more to say.
Well, until we've settled on an asset allocation, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to hire or even consider hiring an EM manager.
That's right.
Because if we stay with the same portfolio setup that we have now, which I personally, that's not the direction I would like to see us move, but if we stayed with that, then it would be purposeless. So I think for me, we're a little bit cart ahead of the horse here in that we haven't decided on the asset allocation.
And thus the chicken and egg.
Why talk about getting a manager for something that we may not be increasing?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm probing whether I should bring back asset allocation mixes to you that consider EM or not. And I felt the pushback before, so I don't want to waste our collective time doing it or get buy-in, and yeah, let's move forward with it. So that's where we're going with it. But you do touch on a really important point in that we're trying to construct a portfolio. And just like Dodge and Cox is trying to construct their stock portfolio or their bond portfolio or LSV or any of our managers, it's this combination of things that we bring together to create that portfolio. So we could absolutely have an emerging market exposure that does not do what we wanted it to do, that loses money and the emerging markets are down and what have you, and we're upset about it. It's, yeah, but that trade-off is that there's a correlation between how that behaves and everything else. And when emerging markets are down, something else in our portfolio is up. And when emerging markets are up, something else in our portfolio is down. And these things start working in balance and offset each other. And that's smart and natural, and that's what we want to see in terms of portfolio construction.
What about movement over time rather than big jumps?
Moving into phasing into it.
Just as we do with our actuary who comes in and says, we've got to make these changes, and we do it over 3 years. What you presented was a pretty big change.
Right. Right.
Okay. Maybe we're more comfortable going into it step at a time in some way, however we do that.
Implementation.
In other words,
yeah.
Saying, okay, we've got this disparity between 6.1 and 7.2 or whatever, but we slowly ease in and maybe have to go from both directions. I don't know.
Yeah.
The problem is Ed bought a house and the last person that owned it left all their ugly furniture in it. And he's got to move all the ugly furniture out so he can get the stuff in that he likes.
Well,
and we've got some ugly stuff in his eyes. And he's just trying to help us smooth our portfolio out.
What about throwing one out at a time?
But you have a strategy when you're doing it peacefully.
Yeah.
And I think you have to have, at this point, we haven't said what that end house is even going to look like. And so it...
But we have, it's six point something.
Well, I mean, we haven't decided, are we going to go with an FFP or option two or any of the different portfolios. Even if we're going to transition over a period of time, we still have to, you know, if you start out on a road trip, you have to know where you're going. And we haven't picked where we're going yet.
What's
so
the 25% difference between the 6.5 and the 7? 25% income difference. That's huge. So...
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if you think that by taking investment out of American companies or American businesses and putting it in their commercial markets that you make a gap, 25% gap, then, you know, you're like a genius or if it works. And it's been a pretty welcome secret in Portland because I've read about this elsewhere.
Well, emerging markets was one of the components there, too, Mike. So we also had the private equity discussion. We had the private credit discussion. Those are two big return generators as well. And the risk parity, which is a nice characteristic because it does a nice job of generating a return and helping to protect the portfolio and draw down years. It had a nice 2008. It was, you know, kind of a down 13% versus our portfolio down 20 plus or whatever it was. I'd have to recheck those numbers. So
I don't know. We're going to talk about circles for a long time. I'm willing to look at risk parity. I mean, I could have went with one of the percentages or the scenarios you had across the page here.
Okay.
Risk parity, I don't understand it because of the lack of experience. But it made sense when you explained it. I think we're way behind the curve on private equity. Everyone else that's been investors have been here for a long time. They're past the J curve and they're making a lot of money. And I think we should look at the one I would probably endorse with the least enthusiasm is a real deep dive into emerging markets, but I think it should be part of the mix.
Okay. So
I would totally agree with Trustee Grover and that we do need to pick a direction and go.
I mean, the discussion we had last, so 7.75 to 7.25 cost you guys how much more a year?
At least 5 million.
Yeah. And what if it's 25% of our portfolio? What's that number if we miss it?
I'd be cautious with too much of that type of asset in emerging markets. If you look at this company here with the Morgan Stanley, so that type of investment looks pretty good. I don't see, you know, real volatility there. It looks like it's a good investment. Emerging markets, you know, very risky. And you wonder, you know, if we have a profit in something like that, are our managers going to get us out of it before it goes down? Because they're just up and down, you gotta get out at times.
I think in Brazil, it's like every election year, it like changes. The government gets indicted.
Every week. Do you have the periodic element of returns?
I don't have it with me,
but
it's in our quarterly reports.
They're fairly stable, and
that would
be
valuable.
Really,
I think so.
Yeah.
Ed, can you bring back in the future something like a dynamic analysis where we could put on a spreadsheet and put it up for all the board to look at as to what the projected discount rate would be given certain allocations? Let's say we want to devote only 18% to emerging markets, and of that, 5% to emerging managers and stuff like that. Can we do something like that where we can really quickly see what the impact, the projected impact of our decision may be?
The scenarios are our way of answering that question.
Right.
The actual computation behind it.
Can we do it on the fly, though? Because I have a feeling that marginally we may come to some agreement here. Yeah, I would think we could, too. I think marginally we could. It may sound ridiculous, but we can come to an agreement.
We actually just built this for private clients.
No, I know we can do it.
And it, I mean, you just tweak the model and see what the difference is.
But would that make us feel comfortable if we could just look at the fly and see what if we didn't do quite so much to emerging markets?
That's not a spreadsheet exercise.
We need to get his scenarios back on there that he had on the page.
It's not a spreadsheet tool.
And now that we understand it better, because we went through all seminars now.
We'll
talk
later. It's not.
Right?
It's not a spreadsheet.
Talk about what they really mean. What's risk parity really mean now? It was just 5% in a line before. What's it mean? What's private equity mean?
But I mean, let's say he says 20% in this scenario, and the other one's 15%. We might want to know what it is. I know how crazy this sounds, but we might want to know what it is if we choose 18%, and it's not on one of the lists.
Well,
so,
and I want to know if we're going from 2 to 18. Where are we taking that from? And what that would have been for us.
Can we, us and anybody else, talk about how to do that, what you're asking for, offline?
Well,
I don't know if you can do it or how it's going to come about, or maybe it can't be, but...
No, we can't do it. We can't do it. Our approach to it is the scenarios that we create for you. And to create the scenarios, we do that. So we're creating lots and lots of looks at things to come up
so
with what we present to you.
So I don't want to bore anybody here. So you don't...
Well, let me just finish.
Okay, go ahead.
So in doing that, we create mixes for you that really highlight where you want to be on a risk-return profile and give you distinct offerings. You can easily over-engineer this mm-hmm. because there's the fallacy of precision that because we're showing you a 3.2 or a 6.4, look, it's a 10-year number. And the one thing I can tell you it's not going to be is 3.2 or 6.4.
I think it's valid.
It's our best approach.
But yeah. What I hear today, we may not be able to come to an agreement based on a deterministic set of asset allocations. I'm just saying.
And we get partway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, maybe you can find something that's between.
Then honestly, we're not a good client of Ed's.
We're
refusing to take the advice that we're paying for.
No, we're saying we want to go into it slowly. There's a big difference.
I haven't heard that.
We used to be dodging talks only. We made a huge change, but we didn't do it in one day. We didn't do it in one session. It may take us time.
Oh, it will definitely take us time. Even if we approve the asset allocation today, we wouldn't get to a full implementation for at least a year.
Okay,
or so more, because we have assets on the books that are legacy assets that we can't call Morgan Stanley today and say, send us our $15 million back if we wanted it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, there are assets on the books that he's just going to have to live with.
Same with private equity.
For maybe a decade.
While to build back.
Yeah, so maybe he has to try to move us slowly to where we should be.
Yeah, but we have to know where that is.
But we haven't even picked a direction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I think is our first problem is that we haven't picked a portfolio yet.
Yeah.
So why don't we set up a timetable for doing that?
Well, Ed, it was like November of last year.
It was December, a full working session.
We're almost there.
So you basically have, call it 10 models for all clients, and everybody lands in one of those 10 asset allocation models. The managers may be different, the sleeves may be different, but the allocation model is the same?
Yes and no. You are your own client. We construct portfolios for you. Yours will look similar to others because we do a lot of work with other county plans that have similar issues that they're wrestling with and similar investment constraints, so there will be similarities to it.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well, I think we, Madam Chair, we've...
Can I say one thing first
Killed this.
Before we go on? I feel compelled to say this, and you've probably heard it before, and forgive me if you have, but the board needs to realize that we're not going to hit a home run with every investment here. It's just not going to happen. And your fiduciary duty does not extend to picking specific assets and specific investments within the asset classes. Your fiduciary ability applies to the asset allocation.
Yep.
And the asset allocation is what Ed is offering us. He's offering you, I think we have 6 on the table right now, 6 different asset allocations on the table with different risk return characteristics. That's what he's offering us. Whether you do it fast or slow, that's fine with me. But your fiduciary duty truly lies in the asset allocation that you pick, because that describes what, 95% of the returns theoretically,
yeah,
is based on the asset mix that you choose. That's where your fiduciary duty lies. So to start trying to pick apart emerging markets and stuff, I understand the need to do it. I truly, truly do. It's a human instinct in all of us. But your fiduciary duty does not really go that deep. It really stops at the asset allocation level. That's all I got to say.
In that session that we had a few months back, we were given different asset allocations.
Correct.
And we all picked one.
And we winnowed it down to 6, I believe. We have 6 left on the table. It could be less than that. But
I thought it was like 3.
Should we take the 3 or 4 or 6 or whatever the number might be that we have?
You're right.
And everybody pick, rank their 3?
We can do it. And that's an interesting concept, because that's what some systems actually do. They have their little private voting things, and they will vote on what's most important to them. And one of those things, obviously, is
that. Where do you need to do that, ITAC?
We did it last. Remember, we did it last.
Yeah. We can write it down.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
Which one do you like? It's which one smells the worst to you. That's what you want to say. But at least you get a vote.
Let us do this. Let us bring back those asset allocations that were on the table.
If we took a 15-minute break at 3 o'clock or at 2:45, we couldn't just get a copy of those?
We can, but remember last month, I want also to discuss the implementation resources that are going to be necessary to administer some of these more complex portfolios.
Well, since we know we're going to probably get there
exactly.
slowly.
Exactly. I want to.
We got to get that on the table.
Next month. So that's what I'm asking. Next month, we'll bring back those three or four different portfolios that we have. We'll bring back the administrative issues that may be a part of those portfolios, and we'll try to get it done next month.
And they do differ depending on what you choose.
Huh?
Your administrative changes depending on what's chosen?
Exactly. Okay. I mean, if we go into private equity, and I just assume that the administrative burden is linear related to how much we have invested in private credit, there's a lot more to do.
Okay.
And I want you folks to know that before you throw that out there. So if I could, if you allow us to do it this way, bring it back next month with the whole picture. And if you decide on an asset allocation, great. If we want to slowly integrate it, that's another discussion. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. We got to know where we're going before we start the journey. Yep.
We're going to have a
Hey, Mike, to that gas reservoir in Milan, Italy, for sure.
You want to go to Brazil during the Olympics?
Okay, okay, so are we moving on now? Do we need to take an action on the act on the?
There is no discussion.
Okay.
Ed has one more thing to say.
Yeah, yes. I think we had still an outstanding issue, even on those last six mixes, or all, however many there were last time, was the concept of FFP and thinking about that. That has a direct implication in terms of how we would model the fixed income portion of the portfolio and how we'd want to think about that, too. So I think that what you have in your materials from past meetings probably needs to be updated to meet that.
So can we get that from you to have it?
Well, I think we need some direction from the board on that as well.
The FFP?
Yes.
I think it was a concept that at least three trustees out of six voted for. So I think it's on the table.
Okay.
Can you also give us back dollars as well as percentages? Sometimes we see percentages we don't associate with dollars. If you're going to move 10% of the portfolio, that's X dollars.
Just like a rebalance.
And that's what I mean. It goes from here to there. Yeah.
We can do it.
Okay. Anything else on this topic? Or we'll move on to Executive Director Administrative.
Okay, item 8A is a presentation and acceptance of the June 30th, 2015 final actuarial evaluation and the 2012-15 final actuarial experience study. It's a discussion action item. Staff recommendation is to accept the final June 30th, 2015 actuarial evaluation and the 2012-15 experience study as presented. And this item will be presented by Rick and Graham.
Give it over to Graham. He's the actuary.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. We're going to start this before we take a break.
This probably is going to go very quickly, I would imagine.
Well, yeah. I'm just going to read out loud.
We can take a break.
There's so much material to cover.
If somebody needs a break, just take
5 minutes.
Well, you've already seen them a couple of times.
Go. I will now proceed to read 144 pages.
Slow down.
How you doing? So I'm actually going to cover this very quickly. We've already discussed both of these reports at length. So there's only a couple sections that I actually wanted to highlight. I'm happy to answer any questions on both reports, but you've seen the numbers and you've adopted the assumptions. So one thing I just wanted to, and this ties in the conversation you were just having, I just wanted to do a little bit of a reminder, and since some of you weren't here for all of the assumption discussions, just keep in mind what you did adopt in terms of the economic assumptions. A 7.25% expected rate of return, that's over a 110-year period. That's not a 10-year period. We are projecting these assets forward as long as you are expected to make benefit payments to the recipients of this plan. So that could go out another 100 years. So there's a time horizon thing to think of. Also remember that you have an inflation assumption of 3%. The assumption that your investment consultant has, I believe, is 2.1 for the 10-year. And a lot of investment consultants are in the similar range, somewhere around 2.5 is sort of the upper end of the investment consultant. So that means that you are expecting to earn 4.25% above inflation over the long term. Verus's assumptions, I think, came out for your current portfolio just over 4%. So there's not actually a huge dichotomy between your assumption about what you think you're going to earn above inflation in your current assumptions versus what Verus is, and versus what other investment consultants are. So some of the information in our report showed that a sampling of investment consultants had a slightly more optimistic view of the investments. But in both cases, your expected real return assumption is very close to your consultants, and it's actually more conservative than what this larger sampling was. That matters, because even if you earn less than 7.25% over the next 10 years, if inflation ends up being 2 or 2.1 instead of 3%, your liabilities are going to be lower than what we're projecting, right? If pay increases are only 2% instead of 3.25%, our projected benefit payments would be lower. So yes, you may have some asset losses over that time, but those may be offset by liability gains because the benefit payments and the COLAs wouldn't be as high as expected. One thing we did recommend in that report is, for the benefit of your plan sponsors, do some projections that show what the cost might look like if you only earn 6% over the next few years. And we can balance that out by showing what the liability gains might look like if you have lower inflation as well. So that's just one thing I wanted to highlight when we talk about the...
translating that, what we've been talking about, 6.1 versus 7.25, that gap is not so big.
That gap is not as big as it appears just looking at those two numbers, because you have something else that's different, and that something else is inflation, and that does influence what we think the benefit payments are going to be. Okay? Does that, everybody... And that's one thing we try to talk about any time we talk about these economic assumptions. Hone in on that real rate of return, that rate of return above inflation.
Graham, just to make sure we don't go out of here thinking, no, it's not really a problem. In the last 100 years, there have been rates of inflation higher than 3%.
Sure. And over
the
last 100
years? 100 years, there's probably going to be.
Sure.
So it's...
And over the last 100 years, you've had economic returns above 7%, right? But you've had good history of earning 4% or more above inflation over the real, over the long term, at least within the U.S. markets. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, you know, that's one tricky thing for the actuarial assumptions versus the investment consultant, is the time horizon and that inflation assumption. And we've moved that inflation assumption a long way from where it started. When we first started working with you, that inflation assumption was either 4 or 4.25%.
4%.
You're down to 3, right? So that's actually a pretty big movement in that inflation assumption. Turns out the investment markets have changed their assumptions about inflation even more. We talked about mortality a whole lot. I'm not going to talk about it too much more. I did want to point out there is some language in the valuation, in the experience study, that talks about the mortality assumptions that we use to come up with the employee contribution rates. And I just want you to specifically know that this information is in there. Remember, one of the things that you've adopted is something called generational mortality, where we assume that somebody who's born in 1950 is going to have a different rate of dying than somebody who's born in 1951, and so forth, right? The later you are born, the longer you're expected to live. When it comes to setting the employee contribution rates, however, you know that the employee contribution rates under the 37X systems for the pre-PEPRA employees are based on your age at entry, right? What we're not doing is suggesting that you come up with a different employee contribution rate for somebody who was born in 1970 versus somebody who was born in 1971 if they were both hired at the same age, okay? We're not sure that the CERL would allow that, and we think there's ways to deal with that when you're using these mortality assumptions. Basically, we just come up with the average assumption for your active population. We say, okay, what's the average duration for your active employees? When do we think the benefits on average are going to be paid? And we come up with a projected mortality table that sort of encompasses the average for your employees. So that's how we deal with not having to come up, you know, we already have tables after tables after tables of employee contribution rates by entry age. We didn't want to come up with tables after tables after tables for every single birth year for every single entry age. So that's there's some information that's discussed about that in the experience study report. Just wanted to highlight that. As far as the valuation report goes, I reviewed all the numbers already. So all I want to focus on are the charts on pages 12 and 13. And those show the projection of the contribution rates under the actuarial fantasy. Remember the actuarial fantasy that you're actually going to earn 7.25% every single year and everybody's going to, you know, retire exactly when we expect and so forth. So this shows you what, if all of our assumptions were met, what would the, what happened to the contribution rates over the next 20 years? Currently, I think the rate we came up with was 25.99% of pay for the employer, so that rounds to that, or 25% for the current year. We do expect it to increase over the next 2 years as you phase in those, the impact of those assumption changes based on the action the board took last month. Then we expect the contribution rates to flatten out and gradually decline, especially as you have more and more of the legacy employees being replaced by Pepper new hires who have the lower normal cost. So that's why you see that sort of gradual pattern of decline. We know it's not going to look like this. You're not going to earn 7.25% every year. You know, we have the projection tools. I have a spreadsheet with us. We've shared it with Rick. You've shared that with the employers as well to say, okay, well, what happens if we just earn, you know, 2% this year? What would that do to our contribution rate? So we have the tools available. We can do that modeling live, any meeting you would like us to, or at your direction, we can provide that information to your plan sponsors. I know, you know, you may not see us again, you know, until later in the fall. If the employers would like to know, hey, after June 30th and we have an idea what our asset returns have been, it's possible to give them those projections. Okay. Turning to page 13, you can see the projection of the funded ratio and the assets and liabilities under that same set of assumptions. Currently, you're around 74% on that smooth basis. We are expecting that by the end of the 20-year period, if you earned your assumption, you'd be back to almost 100% funded. So, you know, there is a there's the expectation that the higher level of contributions that are coming into the plan are going to improve the funded ratio over time if you continue to earn that 7.25%. One thing I just want to let you know, and I've done this projection for a number of systems, is that if you underperform that 7.25% assumption by about a percent, like let's say you only earned about 6.25%, it's not going to cause your plan to blow up. What most of the projections I've run have shown that if you underperform by about a percent a year over the next 10 years, your contribution rate, instead of sort of steadily declining, might be fairly flat. Flat, maybe slightly upticking. But that's not what's going to happen either. You're not going to earn 6.1% every year. You're going to earn 20%. Then you're going to earn negative 10%, right? So don't think that, don't mistake my 7.25 or your 7.25% assumption for gospel and then say, well, no, actually it's going to be 6.1% year after year after year. It's always going to be up and down, okay? So these are the, right, you've got the actuarial fantasy projections as part of this report. You've got a lot of other information, assumptions, asset tables, demographic data, but again, I'm not going to read every 144 pages of what we put in front of you, but I'm happy to answer any questions on the information.
So, Graham, when you model the 7.25%, what volatility do you model with that?
Well, for this projection, there's no volatility, right?
Straight
it's
line.
It's a straight line. For, we have a tool that we have that we've shared with Rick before that does a stochastic simulation of the assets, and we can plug in whatever standard deviation of the portfolio you have. We can actually model that portfolio the same way you would with the correlation coefficients that you do,
okay,
that you input. So if you would like to see, and I think we've showed the board this before, instead of showing that straight line, what's the cloud look like, right? What are those distributions? What are those color bands, those confidence intervals? That's something that we're putting in more and more presentations, including some we've given to this board. And those, the spreading of the contribution rates, that will depend significantly on the volatility of your portfolio. And for that information, we'd really be talking to your investment consultants about what they expect the deviation of the portfolio to be.
Graham and Ed, actually on your allocation models, mm-hmm, do you provide a Monte Carlo simulation?
We can. We don't typically.
Because it would be really cool to put both Monte Carlos next to each other.
So we ran the information in the experience study. We were Bear's provided us their correlation matrix and their standard deviation arithmetic returns for each asset class. We modeled those using our own simulations and came up with the same expected geometric return that they did. So that was a nice, a nice fit.
Yeah.
We also ran that simulation on a survey of other investment consultants, and that information is in your report as well. And they came up, that came up with a higher expected rate of return than the Verus assumptions. They're just more conservative in some of those asset classes, particularly fixed income. I think over the 10-year horizon from that survey, they were saying something like 4.4%. I think yours was in the low threes, right?
So to swing back to Ed, I mean, when you bring those three asset allocation models back, if you could bring the Monte Carlo with them, I think that would be beneficial because we can tie it back to Graham's report.
And Graham has the tools to be able to plug in an expected return and a standard deviation and generate exactly what he's talking about.
Right.
So we could show you
translating
the asset allocation assumptions into contribution rates could be done on a live basis.
Yeah.
So Graham, I have a question on the employee contribution rates. So for different tiers, do they correlate between the employer contribution change? So like if the employer contribution rate for a given tier changes by 10%, is there a correlation on how much the employee contribution rate should go up?
The employee contribution rates change very little compared to the employer rates.
Right.
And that's because the employee contribution rates are dependent on only your forward look. They are based on, to some extent, what we would call the normal cost of the plan. Right? The cost of the benefits that you're accruing this year.
Right, because they could be changing, right? Today we have this employee that might not be there tomorrow. It's kind of that kind of thinking as well?
Well, actually, we do it on an individual employee-by-employee basis.
Okay.
So we say, okay, so for somebody who's hired at age 30, what percentage of pay would you need to put aside so that by the time they reach age 60, they will have accumulated a 1% of pay benefit? And that number will only change in any given year if you change your assumptions about what's going to happen in the future. Versus the employer contribution rates, those change anytime your investment, you know, your past experience has changed, right? Because the employers pay the unfunded liability of the plan. And the unfunded liability is the thing that shifts significantly from year to year. Versus the normal cost, the cost of the benefits that you're earning this year, we really only measure changes in that if you're changing your assumptions significantly. And even with the changes that you made this year in your assumptions, which were pretty significant, the employee rates didn't change a whole lot.
Some did.
Well, some of them did at the higher entry age.
We looked at it already. You know,
it's not fun.
One thing, too, you might have said this a second ago, but the employer rates this year, the changes are being phased in over 3 years, where
the assumption changes for the
employees are getting hit all at once this year.
Right. The other thing is that the PEPRA employee contributions, which are becoming a larger and larger percentage of your plan, those are pegged every year to what is half the normal cost, right? What's half the cost of the benefits that people are earning this year. And those will change every year. Those are not expected to change significantly unless the plan population changes a whole bunch.
Maybe we could talk about this offline, but there's one tier in the safety that did not, on the employee side, did not have a contribution.
Tier 3? Tier 3 is not safe.
Tier 4. Last year, they did not, according to the evaluation for last year, they did not have a contribution.
Okay.
Now they do on the employee side.
Okay, so we'll have to look at who's in the tier. You stop contributing once you achieve 30 years of service. So we've had tiers where if there aren't a lot of people, sometimes all of a sudden it can look like there's no contributions because the person may have gotten 30 years, may have hit 30 years of service. But we can review that offline about the exact tier if you want.
Yeah.
Okay, so today we're just accepting this information, is that correct?
I think you need to adopt it because you're adopting the contribution rates that will go to the plan sponsors.
I think just by accepting the valuations that...
Because didn't we already do that last time?
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
we didn't provide you this report last time.
We sent him away to go do his work, and now this is his final product.
I move that we accept the report as presented.
Reports
as presented.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Quick follow-up on the Monte Carlo request. We don't typically provide it because the Monte Carlo analysis doesn't show us any additional insights. Monte Carlo is a tool to be used with what they call a discontinuous time series. And we model everything assuming continuity, so it ends up creating a picture that is remarkably similar to what you get in our reports as it is. So we're not making a change in the assumption that gives us sheds any additional light from the investment return perspective.
Okay. Well, but if you have three different asset allocation models and you Monte Carlo those out, there would be evidence that one is going to be maybe better than the other two given risk.
They'll demonstrate the same return risk profile that the normal distribution characteristics have. So I could draw that picture for you the same way, either way.
Okay.
So it doesn't give us any additional benefit.
The reason that we use it is to give you a better idea of what the uncertainty in the contribution rates is, right? So rather than having this single line of here's what we expect the contribution rate to be, we do that simulation and it shows you here's where the contribution rates might end up.
And that's the right way to apply it.
Cool. You run a Monte Carlo, it shows you what that allocation change difference would be.
I would think that given a specific asset allocation with an expected return, correlation between assets, standard deviation, one would be able to generate return scenarios, say, for 10-year periods of time.
You can, and you could generate as many as you want, and you'd end up drawing the exact same picture of the normal curve. Because
log normal.
Right. Yeah. Because you're not making any additional insight into why the markets need to be modeled using Monte Carlo simulation.
Which I see what you're saying. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But the shape of the bell curve is going to be different.
No. Yes.
Yes, it has to be.
No.
There's different risk parameters.
Well, that's the thing. You're using the same risk parameters whether you're modeling it
for different asset allocations?
One time.
I mean, if you're 60% U.S. and 40% fixed income with one and then flip that on the other, that's going to be different.
Each asset mix will have a different distribution, yes.
Correct.
But if you take a single single asset mix and model it with Monte Carlo or model it...
No. I meant taking the individual allocations and showing a Monte Carlo.
That's what I'm saying. You don't get any additional insight versus what we currently show you on it. Do you want to handle this offline?
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing I want,
yeah.
Okay, we'll have a little group session. The other thing I wanted to note was, so if we model 7.25 with 0% volatility, that would be great. If we could find that investment, we would be doing it, right? That would be awesome. We have volatility, and because of volatility, you have to get a higher return because of volatility. Volatility eats away at your return. So we close the gap by saying, look, we have a whole percentage point difference in our inflation assumption. That's great. Yes, we do. So if we look at it on a real versus real basis, we close the gap there. But when we actually have real results that have volatility in them, as opposed to straight line 7.25%, we actually have to generate a higher than 7.25% to earn an effective 7.25%. So.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay, at this point, it's 3 o'clock, and I would like to take a 15-minute break, if everybody's amenable. 10?
How about 6?
Okay, 5.
I don't think there's much left of the rest of the meeting either.
Oh, I was thinking there was some a fair amount of talking. Okay, we're gonna take a 5-minute break. Okay, so it's 3:10, and we are back in session. So the next one... Information Technology Solutions Project Update.
Actually, we asked for item 8E to be heard out of order so that Ed would be able to address that and then be able to hit the road.
Okay, so we're going to talk about discussion and action regarding Stan Sara monthly meeting schedule.
Okay. Go ahead, Kelly.
Eight E is SAMHSA's monthly meeting schedule. It's a discussion in action. Staff recommendation is to move to a single monthly meeting from the third Wednesday of each month to the fourth Wednesday of each month, with the exception of November and December. This item will be discussed and presented by Rick Samples.
Okay. Okay, so as Kelly said, we're recommending that we keep the single monthly meeting format. Essentially, that what we've found is that there are a lot of tasks, preparative tasks, that are duplicated when we have each time we have a meeting. So, and I also know from my own personal perspective that I seem to be getting my agenda items done sooner than I did when we had two meetings, and I find myself able to spend a little bit more time on them. So, from staff's perspective, we all agree that we like the single monthly meetings. That obviously doesn't mean we have to do that. But anyway, we'd also like, we don't know if this is going to, I don't think we can sway you on this, but we would love to have morning start times. We're one of only two systems that have afternoon start times, so everybody else pretty much has morning. But however, since this, I got up out of bed this morning, I had two comments from Fred and Ed on our meeting schedule proposal, so I have a feeling this may be a lively discussion, and I'm going to open it up for discussion, and I'll let Ed and Fred weigh in when they see fit.
I'll let you go first, Ed.
Oh, great. Thanks, Fred.
Check your calendars.
I just have a conflict on Fourth Wednesday. Contra Costa meets that day.
So you would not be able to attend the meeting if we moved it?
It would, yeah. I think it would inject
regardless
some...
Regardless of time.
Yeah.
Does the board have any reservation about having Ed on a conference call or visual up at the monitor? Because let me tell you something. I can tell you right now that Fourth Wednesday was... There's not too many dates that I feel we're all going to agree on here at all.
But if he's in Contra Costa at a meeting, are you available by phone or by
later in the day or
video at any time?
Why don't we go
day?
Back to the Fourth Tuesday?
Well, let's talk.
Supervisor Day.
Supervisor DeMartini has a full
board
day.
In the afternoon, it used to work for me. I mean, this date here does not work very well. Time with it, you know, I didn't really mind so much when you changed it from two meetings a month to one. But then you change the week on top of that. That's what bothers me. I won't be able to even make the next meeting. And I'm missing other stuff because you just change the week. And that's where I'm having a problem.
What time of day is your Contra Costa meeting?
It kicks off at 9:00. And it goes to whenever. It's usually done by 12 or 1.
Yeah, but then there's a drive.
There is a drive. Yeah. Concord to Modesto.
Video conference from over there.
But would you actually do video conference? Previously, there was another person who attended with you, and they said if you weren't able to be here, they would be here. So would we still get you, or would we get that other person?
Was that Scott?
That's Scott, and he has meetings on the Fourth Wednesday.
It's
a very popular day for Sackers Counties.
Yeah, when we did the RFP for investment consultants, we were at two meetings. Mm-hmm. And if they, you know, committed to being here on our investment meeting based upon that. So the fact that we were able to get Ed to switch to the Wednesday and that worked, we were just kind of lucky on that one. Just I wanted to remind you all that it's not Ed not trying to help do what we're asking.
What about Jim, the fourth Tuesday, like what we used to have our investment meetings? Would that work?
So he's got board meeting on Tuesday.
Well, afternoon. I mean,
and I have Rotary.
We've always had fourth Tuesday investment meetings in the past.
What time is Rotary?
Till 1:30. Sometimes quarter to 2:00.
In the afternoon, it'd be okay.
Modesto Rotary.
Yeah. We started at 2:00. They started at noon.
It's supposed to be over at 1:30. Oh.
No, yeah, they're supposed to be over at 1:30, but still have to get over here.
Thursday's great.
I'm a member.
I know you want to.
We created this problem by going to one meeting.
The fourth Thursday or the
third Thursday?
Well, I don't necessarily agree because we can always have our meetings on the fourth Tuesday and keep it a single. We were meeting every fourth Tuesday, so we could continue that practice if we had to. And keep it at a single meeting.
I'm okay on any day. I'm okay at any time. But I think it's important that he and Jim be at the meeting. So
are Thursdays out?
Jim didn't have any problem.
Fred, what's your conflict?
I can't do it in the morning because I have all my court hearings.
Yeah, you're in court.
I only missed one meeting when the board meeting ran really late one time over either animal issue or rent control. I think it was one. That was rare that we go that late.
There are some Rotary members, though, that said that they work at
obligated to a meeting until 1:30 on that day.
You said?
Fourth Thursday? Third Thursday.
Yeah, my only conflict is in the mornings, because all of my court hearings are in the morning. So afternoon is fine.
Mornings
afternoon
are
is fine.
Out for me, too. Same reason.
Okay, well, we heard fourth Tuesday or fourth Thursday.
The third. Because
I don't care about third Thursday.
What?
Works for me.
I've heard it several times that when it was on Tuesday, it wasn't a conflict.
Not in the afternoon.
Nobody complained when it was the second.
Well, only Tuesday, what start time, though?
1 o'clock.
Because Donna has Modesto Rotary that gets out at 1:30.
Tell you, the later we go past 1 o'clock, we're going to be here late, guys.
As a compromise, we could sacrifice half an hour.
Absolutely.
If we do it on
just,
Tuesday
just be aware that we're going to be pushing some meetings.
Well, she's going to need 15 minutes to get here.
Can she leave?
2 o'clock.
I can leave her.
We're looking at 6 o'clock.
You can leave at 1. You can leave before the speaker gets up.
So what date is the, was it the
They meet every
second?
Tuesday.
No, but I mean, the one we're proposing is the fourth Tuesday or the second Tuesday?
I would think if we're trying to get it where we actually have our financial reports, wouldn't we want to go to the fourth rather than the second?
That's what I was just going to bring up, that we don't want to do it too early in the month because then Ed's reports are not going to be available.
What was the problem?
We'll all just be here in the afternoon of a Tuesday and then Connor
that would solve your issues, right?
Oh,
her issue. We have a different issue.
Yeah, it does.
Well,
it's very thoughtful, Jeff.
So the fourth Tuesday.
It would solve her issue.
Fourth Tuesday in the afternoon at 1 o'clock. Does that work for most?
After you go through a couple months cycle, you don't have anything on your calendar anyhow. So it could really kind of be anything.
You guys decide what you want.
I am still going to have Rotary, so 1:30 would probably be the
earliest. I know we make 1:30 on Tuesdays. What's it, first?
The fourth.
Fourth Tuesday.
It's not good. And I will personally go with you to Lynn and ask if you can leave by then.
So fourth Tuesday, 1:30.
Or the judges always used to get up at like 20 after 1 and leave anyhow because they were going to be back in their chamber.
1:30, yeah.
Okay.
Well, if the judges can leave, I can.
Well, they all retire.
Motion by Michael Lynch. Any second?
You second.
Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Anyone opposed? I guess the motion passes. Fourth Tuesdays at 1:30.
When would it start? 1:30. We'll start immediately.
So
because our managers don't show up here anymore, so May. We can just get them on conference call and they won't mind.
We'll start with the May meeting.
May meeting, yep.
Is the Morgan Stanley guy just confused?
He was. I don't know where. He said he was comfortable with Ed and I. He was going to shoot.
On the 26th.
He's from the Bay Area, though.
He's from LA. He said Los Angeles.
So May 24th.
I always saw him in the Bay. Oh.
He said LA.
May 24th.
Okay. So the next
Memorial
item.
Day weekend?
I don't know when Memorial Day is.
I think it's the 31st.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
Instead of the 18th?
30th.
30th.
So 4th would be the 24th of May.
I'll send you all a new email with new appointments. Yeah.
So are we ready to move on now?
Okay.
Ed.
Oh, I dismissed myself. Thank you all very much. I appreciate the discussion. I can tell you guys care, and that's really key. So I know you're probably happy when I leave this meeting. Give each other high fives.
And here I thought you were running towards the door. Let me out of this room of crazy people.
Thank you.
Okay, Information Technology Solutions Project Update.
Item 8B is a project status update presented by Don Lee.
So you got your plans this month, and we have a little change on that in the little risk and issues box over here. Lenny and I had prepared that we did have that 2 weeks slip that we talked about last month. But we were able to get everything completed on time to get our RFP released on April 29th, not the 15th. So that's that 2 week slip that we were talking about. The district got to change the date. So we do plan to have that available on, which will go out and also be posted on our website, April 29th. And we expect to have phase four completed by the probably, so we can maybe get that to the July meeting then, since it's going to be probably
maybe
not.
July.
It may not be until August until we can get that to the meeting. So we will probably be bringing that to you in the August meeting to approve a vendor.
A lot of moving parts that have to happen before we come for final approval. We'd rather do it right than do it fast at this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
You don't need to do anything with that. That was just an update. Legal legislation update.
Item 8C is alleged legal update brought to you by Don Lee.
And we have nothing new to report this month.
Discussion and action for voting proxy of State Association of County Retirement Associations, Retirement Systems, 2016 business meeting.
Okay, item 8D is a discussion and action item that will be presented by me, Kelly Gomes. Please bear with me. We did get the business packet, as I indicated to you, not very timely, so I'm going to try to summarize it for you and explain what I'll need from you today. So this item was received by Sackers for the spring business meeting to be held on May 13th, 2016. Sackers, the State Association of California County Retirement Systems, for those of you that are new, is an association of 20 California county retirement systems enacted under the County Employees Retirement Law of 1937. Sackers now meets as an organization twice a year with 20 counties. Education and legislation are the principal focus of these meetings, particularly education in the investment and fiduciary responsibility arena. As for the item today, first I will ask you for two voting proxies, one being the primary and one being the alternate, and then I will be asking you to give direction for your voting proxies on four separate items. I will give you a brief description if you would like them to be able to give them a directive. My hope is that you have all had time to read the business packet that was sent out, but if you have any questions, hopefully I'll be able to provide you answers. So first, if I could get a volunteer to be the primary proxy. I currently am aware of two and possibly three people that are attending.
Who are they?
Michael Neal is attending, Joan is attending, and it's a possibility that Donna Riley will be able to attend. She might have a conflict in schedule.
I may not be there the whole week. That's the only issue for me.
I'm not sure if you would like to attend, Mike.
I'm going to have a group starting tomorrow or Friday.
It's better than tomorrow.
So, Mike, the benefit of that is you don't have to stand in line at the airport. They let you go to the front of the line.
But you can't leave the conference. You can't speak out of the session.
That's the benefit.
Not too fast, right? Can we politely request that Michael, since you already had a deal, would be the representative and Joan be the backup?
That is very good. Joan, are you okay with that? You can be the alternate.
Good one.
Mike, do you agree to be the?
Sure.
Okay, perfect.
And Okay. Hopefully I'll be there all week. I need the credits.
Okay, now I would like the four separate motions for the following items for the business meeting. 6A is AB 1853. Would authorize the retirement board of any retirement system operating under CIRL to elect by resolution to be a district under the law. The bill would authorize the board to adopt by resolution specific administration provisions that would classify various personnel in retirement systems as employees of the retirement system and not employees of the county. In regard to county employees who would become retirement system employees, the bill would prescribe requirements in connection with their compensation and employee benefits and status. Ultimately, this would not preclude us from doing business as we do under the county today, This would only allow counties to elect by resolution to be a district under law should they choose to. Any discussion? Any questions?
Do you want to be a county employee?
Do I personally want
to
be?
We don't have to. This is just gives people the option. This doesn't force anything upon us at all. Maybe 20 years down the road, this system may want to do this. I think it. I think in as these systems mature, get bigger, they tend to go this way. But this is just an option.
So you recommend it? Yes.
But systems have gone that way with individual county.
But then they have to go and get legislation.
Right, they got
to
get legislation.
Just,
it cleans it up.
Right.
I think the issue before, Jeff, was that we all felt that it made the process a little too sterile and too easy to do. And before, you guys were against this. This is the final. You're not going to hear about this again. So they're just going to ask you to vote yes, no, or abstain. I don't think it's that big a deal because we don't have to change anything what we do. It just gives us the option later.
In concept, at their last business meeting, it did pass from the other boards, but not that should sway your decision
right here.
But it doesn't change the fact that there would still have to be some heavy discussions and a lot of things put in place before any county would be able to go. It would just go independent or be a special district. It would just help in that legislative part that they wouldn't have to go individually.
Let me clarify just a little bit more. I do think, though, it puts all the decision into the power of the retirement board, whereas now I think there's a lot of back and forth between the counties and the retirement boards, and there has been litigation between the county and retirement boards. So I agree with Kelly what you said. That's exactly true, but I also think it just gives the board of retirement, say, you know what? Let's just do it.
And I'm sure it matters what county you are in and what retirement board you are, how large or how small, and how they operate together well or not. We work very well together with our county. But when I say that it would have just that legal piece to be able to do it, they would still have to have all those negotiations about whether or not they could still have medical from a big provider, if they could still, option back all these pieces. So all of those real big decisions that would a retirement board would need to make and consider before going a special district would still have to be worked out. This is, from what their big item sounded like, just the legislative piece to allow it.
Mike, do you know from CRCEA Legislative Committee where this is coming from? Who's pushing it?
This is a Sackers.
This is a Sackers.
Well, but who brought it to Sackers?
Was it San Diego? Not this one.
No, they did the other one. I don't know. I think this is comes out of the Contra Costa thing
Contra
that just
Costa
happened.
Just did it,
and they had a lot of trouble with it.
And they had to go back and basically repeat everything. Either Osers or San Bernardino did. I mean, even though they ended up with the same model as San Bernardino or whichever model they chose, they actually had to go back to the legislator to get
find somebody
to
sponsor the legislation and so forth.
So what they're offering, it looks like, is you could take one of the three models, LA's model, San Bernardino's model, or Osers model.
It says it's introduced by Assemblymember Cooper. I don't know if that means anything.
Cooper.
It doesn't call out a county. Right.
So if the bill passes, then does Stan Serra has to go back to our board of supervisors to get their okay to do this?
I don't believe so.
No, we would.
They're saying that that's what changes. Now
so
they
it's
have
automatic. Then if it passes,
No.
It's optional.
No.
This board would have to vote to do that. But the thing is, there's all bits and pieces that would have to be ironed out in a contract with the county in order for that to even happen, and allowing them legislatively other counties to do that doesn't make us have to do anything. We would stay exactly as we are until
we choose not to.
Yep, so
there's some county out there that wants
to. I would like a motion to
and this will make
direct
it easier.
Your proxy to
I don't
vote
have
for you.
Yes, no, or abstain.
Either,
for it or against it.
I make a motion that we ask what? That our proxy would vote yes.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, so our... all in favor of allowing our proxy to vote yes on this? So we are directing our vote.
And the operating board is allowing.
Well, we haven't voted yet.
Oh, I thought we had.
No, that was just the first and the second.
Sorry, I got ahead of myself.
It'll be up to you.
Is there everyone in favor?
Aye.
All opposed.
You guys want to go
anyone opposed? No. Okay, then the motion carries. We will be voting in favor of it.
Okay. Sorry, bear with me. 6B on the agenda for the business meeting is AB 2376. This will add language that will allow counties to collect certain data and no longer require a sworn statement by each member. Ultimately, this would not preclude us from doing business as we currently do by requiring the sworn statements. It would allow counties to make this change should they choose to. Sackers is only asking for the support to sponsor this one provision in the bill. They have not sponsored this bill in its entirety. It's being brought forth through, and I'm going to say it wrong, the
CRCA.
They are sponsoring it. But I did want to give you just in briefly, because it wasn't presented very timely, there's a lot of different pieces in that item. It's not just for that. For instance, it would also give the voting ability to our alternate trustee on our board. If it passed, it would allow for the alternate to vote in other cases, not just when the eighth member is absent. There was some other things about safety and things in it as well. So it wasn't just like the other one that was just cut and dry and only dealt with one thing.
If we had an alternate safety member.
No, this is you.
This is your spot.
It's my understanding that if we had an alternate safety member and there was a regular member missing, that alternate safety member by law now is able. So all we're doing is making...
Correct. It sounded like it would make the law for you, your seat, be like the law for the safety
alternate
one, meaning that seat 2 would have to be absent and seat 5 at the same time before you could vote. But it would give you more voting options than just, and the only reason I'm pointing that out, not that it matters one way or the other, is I was just trying to indicate that it was a much bigger bill, but they were only asking us to weigh in on that.
For example, if they were gone and Joan was here, we could continue to conduct business.
What's that thing?
I think you should approve it.
Okay. Move approval.
Second?
Yes.
Is there a second? Sorry.
Second.
Was that Mandeep?
Mandeep.
Thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? So we'll be voting yes on both of those.
Okay, item 7 on the business meeting agenda is Sackers bylaw. This will add new language to better define alternate delegates and define voting proxies. This will not change anything, but hopefully make it clear that the retirement board can appoint who they want as proxies, and that the proxies vote the system retirement board wishes. Apparently,
so you could appoint staff if none of you wants to go in the future.
You know, if no one was there, or you had to leave, or you had to leave, and Rick was the only one there, you could Captain make him your vote.
Exactly.
There was a county that brought it up and wanted some clarification.
Yeah. I move approval.
It.
Yeah.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Anyone opposed? We'll be voting yes on 3.
Okay, last one I have for you is item 8 on their agenda. It's the Sackers Board of Directors 2016-17 ballot. This is the same ballot as proposed to you at our 3/16 meeting, so meaning that no other counties asked for anybody else to be added on there. So if you didn't have a chance to see it in today's item, it was the one we reviewed last month. So I just need a motion whether to accept that in its entirety or not.
Yeah. Move. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That we'll be voting yes on all of them.
We are a positive group.
We are very upbeat today.
And we're voting proxy forms then. We're taking care of this.
Yep.
We haven't yet because we just decided who would be on it, but after this meeting it will be taken care of and turned in.
Our due diligence chairman just left.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, well.
He can do it.
I do staff him pretty much.
Okay, so I didn't say
he's driving him back to tomorrow.
Okay, so our next item. Oh, I lost my place. 9A. Oh, due diligence committee.
9A is a readout by the due diligence committee regarding the annual due diligence trip. It's, we listed it as a discussion action item, but there's no action for you to take today. We're just going to have a readout.
So just really fast, there was no action taken at the due diligence committee meeting, but we did redefine the way we're going to do due diligence, and essentially we are going to be focusing, when we go out on these trips, we're going to be focusing on being on site and trying to understand whether they've got the technology, infrastructure, disaster recovery in place, and try to detect whether there's any operational risks. And the committee felt that way because we do a lot of the normal due diligence throughout the year, talking about performance, talking about organizational structural changes, and we didn't feel the need to necessarily rehash that out on this trip. So we will just be focusing on site visits and what's going on at the sites.
So you can do more visits or less visits? Or?
We'll do the same visits. Just going to be crafted a little differently.
One every 3 years is what.
Yeah.
And
we're
doing those new emerging markets that we're looking at.
I'm going
to start to get
only
more
to the
knowledge.
Consultant.
You can't appoint whoever you want.
Well, the difference is that that Ed won't be going with us because Paul did them for free and Ed won about $40,000.
Yep.
Which we knew about when
we did. We knew before we signed on the dotted line.
We can drive our own minivan. We don't need to pay to it.
So we don't need an action item on that.
This was last year.
Or a vote on that. Okay.
Some of those due diligence trips are important.
Yeah.
Going to that, what's that one we mentioned? This
Cal Prospects.
I mean, that to me was interesting because it was
sent to their kitchen table.
Yeah, it was an entirely different kind of organization than anything else. So you would have to be there to really get the feel for it. Sometimes you just really need to be there. And I don't think that happens.
Well, I like the idea of talking about their disaster recovery plans and how deep their bench is and things like that. But I think that really will add a lot. All right, so I guess we're going to move into closed session now. We're back into open session. It's a good thing there's not a test.
I do not have any readout for the closed session at this time.
So the last thing is members forum.
Pass.
Great.
Pass.
I guess we're all settled on what you're going to do with that.
With what?
Yeah.
Yes.
The series
guy.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm good. I have improved my outlook because I had cataract surgery a week ago on Monday, and I have my next one next Monday.
Excellent.
Things are looking up.
Excellent.
Yeah. I'm good.
Thank you. I'm good. I just want to say, if there's other things in those bills that bother you and Joe, do what you think is right. Even though we try to get it both.
Well, the thing is that
generally that motion
it's up to this board. They're not
worded,
taking any power away from this board to do whatever they want to do.
Correct.
Yeah, I think, though, Kelly brought up a very, very important point. As you all know, sometimes things get tacked onto these bills at the last minute, and there's a lot more in that one bill than Sackers is asking us to to agree to. Yeah.
So well, and, I'm willing to defer to the and we may find out more about what's going on while we're actually there, and it might start stinking.
So and after we vote and the bill moves forward, you know this very well, that what it starts out at, yep. by the time it gets to be voted on at the legislative level, different ball of wax.
Don? Then that's meeting is adjourned.